Today's episode of Morbidology is brought to you by Old Timey Crimey, a weekly true crime podcast brought to you by Kirsty, Scott and Amber. Old Timey Crimey cover a variety of true crime cases, from the famous ones, such as the Amelia Dyer case, to the more obscure, such as the George Joseph Smith case. What sets Old Timey Crimey apart from other podcasts is that they focus on older cases, which makes them appealing to both true crime fans and history buffs. Plus, with over 100 episodes, including full-length episodes and bonus mini-episodes, there's enough content for you to binge. Old Timey Crimey, because the good old days weren't always so good. Make sure to click the link in my show notes, subscribe and check them out. Welcome to Morbidology, the podcast. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders, Cults Uncovered, and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. Join me weekly as I uncover some of the world's most heinous murders. Linda Stein was known as the rock and roll real estate agent. She had lived the kind of life that would make anybody envious, from managing the Ramones to finding multi-million dollar homes for the rich and famous. Nobody ever envisioned that Linda's life would end in such a gruesome and tragic manner. Linda Stein's career had humble beginnings. She used to teach fifth grade in Riverdale. After obtaining a master's degree in education from Teachers College, Art Columbia University, it was during this time that she met Seymour Stein, co-founder of Sire Records. The couple went on to have two daughters, Mandy and Samantha, before Linda joined the music business of Seymour, who was most known for launching Madonna's music career at Sire Records. Linda would become the manager for the Ramones during their heyday, alongside Danny Fields. She is credited with bringing the Ramones to England for their infamous July 4th, 1976 concert that helped to spark the young British punk scene. While the Ramones had failed in the US, they were extremely well received in Britain, thanks to Linda. In fact, banned in the US, their 1977 single, Sheena is a Punk Rocker, reached number 22 in the British charts, while the 1980 hit, Baby I Love You, made it to the top 10. Danny Fields would later say that Linda had the perfect temperament for the rough and raunchy world of punk. Linda had travelled all across the world and had a number of impressive stories to tell. In 2005, she said, "It's called having fun. I've had a lifetime of it." Those who knew Linda said that she was extremely fiery. She had a temper that would flare with very little provocation, and she swore like a sailor. As her daughter Mandy said, "If she doesn't say fuck 20 times a day, she is repressed." After Linda and Seymour divorced, Linda continued to manage the Ramones and other bands, before deciding to take a different path and become a real estate agent in the 1980s. When asked why she had made the stark change in career, she said, "Doesn't everyone think there's money to be made in real estate?" Unsurprisingly, Linda became the real estate agent to the stars, brokering multi-million dollar homes for the likes of Madonna, Sting, Billy Joel, Angelina Jolie, and Steven Spielberg, in places like Manhattan, Long Island, East Hampton, and even overseas in Paris, London, and Rome. Her clientele consisted of those who wouldn't drop less than $2 million on their new pad. She said, "If a potential client wants to see a property for the 42nd time, well, I'll personally show it for the 42nd time. I'm always focused on good service and on the seal." Linda would typically sell around 20 or 30 properties annually, some of which cost a whopping $30 million. Linda was certainly an exclusive real estate agent and seldom listed her properties. One celebrity who became a close confidant of Linda was Sir Elton John. In fact, Linda and Elton were so close that she named him the godfather of her youngest daughter, Mandy, who was a successful documentary maker. In 2005, Linda was a guest at Elton's civil ceremony. People often gravitated towards Linda because she was sophisticated and bright. She also had a sometimes dry humour and a tempestuous personality, and she didn't take any guff. But underneath that surface, Linda was said to have a heart of gold. Linda's life wasn't all roses and sunshine, and she had her fair share of battles. She had been twice diagnosed with breast cancer. When it was first detected in 1994, Linda volunteered for what was then an experiment involving dose-dense chemotherapy. The chemotherapy would be administered every 2 weeks, as opposed to the traditional every 3 weeks. That same year, she had her first mastectomy and breast reconstruction. Then in 1996, she had a second mastectomy. As news of Linda's cancer spread throughout the real estate community in New York City, many of her rivals began to spread rumors that Linda's career was over and that her era had ended. Linda would say to the New York Sun, "The rock and roll business is mild compared to the real estate industry. If you think you've experienced the most vicious competition, think again." Linda became a staunch advocate for breast cancer awareness and raised millions of dollars. At around 10:30 p.m. on the 31st of October 2007, police in Manhattan were alerted to Linda's 18th floor penthouse apartment in the Upper East Side by her daughter Mandy, who was visiting her from Los Angeles. She had come to her apartment to find her mother face down in the living room, surrounded in a puddle of her own blood.
Police operator 1142, it's emergency. Hello.
I just called. Please, I need an ambulance.
Okay, what happened in there?
My mom, she's dead, I think. I don't know.
What happened?
Help me.
Hello?
Help me.
Hello? What happened?
I came home and my mom is in a puddle of blood. Can you just send something?
Yes,
right
ma'am.
Now?
I sure can. Miss. Hello?
Yeah, patient breathing and awake.
Is this 911?
Yes, it is. It's for a male or a female?
For a female.
How old is the patient? Approximate. How old? Elderly, young?
60.
60. What's wrong, sir?
She's lying on the floor, a lot of blood from her head. The daughter just came in and found her like this.
She's bleeding heavily, sir. It's important.
She's bleeding heavily. She's not moving.
What happened? She felt she hurt herself?
I don't know.
Listen, mister, is she conscious, yes or no?
She's not conscious. She's not moving.
Big question now. Is she breathing? Is she breathing, sir?
She's not breathing.
She's not breathing.
I don't think so. I can't feel like
if I give you
she's lying face down.
Hello, mister. Okay, the ambulance is en route to that location.
She's 62.
Thank you, mister.
Linda's body was taken to the medical examiner's office for a cause of death to be determined. It would be determined that Linda had died from blunt force trauma to the head and neck. It was speculated that the murder weapon had been a hammer. The murder of Linda completely stunned both the real estate community as well as the rock and roll community, where Linda was well known and well liked. Author Stephen Gaines, who wrote about Linda in his book, The Sky's the Limit, Passion and Property in Manhattan, said that their circle of friends were absolutely positive that whoever committed the murder must have been someone unknown to Linda, stating, "She had no enemies of that kind." A number of celebrities would pay tribute to Linda as news of her brutal death swept from New York City to Los Angeles, and everywhere in between. Madonna said that she had seen Linda in the year beforehand at her concert in Madison Square Garden, where they reminisced about the good old days. She said, "I deeply admired her courage in her battle with breast cancer as well as her career success." Elton John said, "I'm absolutely shocked and upset." The murder was ever the more poignant because Linda had fiercely battled breast cancer twice and defeated the disease, only to be murdered in such a violent manner. An investigation of the crime scene would show no evidence of forced entry and no murder weapon. Their first point of action, as well as investigating the crime scene for any clues, was to review security footage from inside the apartment complex, as well as interview her neighbours and employees. The apartment complex had security cameras throughout the lobby and elevator operators. The building was not an easy building for somebody to get into if they didn't belong there. One resident of the apartment complex said, "The security's excellent. No one is allowed in unless they have a name, and they have to deal with the doorman. He then calls up and the person has to come down and get them." Sadly, however, there were no cameras on Linda's floor. Because of this, investigators were quick to say that Linda was either killed by someone who she knew and let into the apartment, or by someone who had access to the building, such as a worker. At the time of Linda's murder, construction workers had been outside, working on the building, and they were all interviewed. And 9 of the workers, who were painting the 16th floor terrace, were DNA tested, while a forensics vacuum lifted paint samples and clothing fibres. One construction worker, Miguel Cheeky, said to the Los Angeles Times, "We signed permission. We wanted to cooperate." According to those closest to Linda, she was very much, "My house is your house. Come by whenever you like." And she had given a key to numerous people. Investigators immediately cast a wide net in their search for Linda's killer. And sources close to the investigation said that Linda's ex-lover, Francisco Arena, was being looked at as a person of interest. Francisco had done some renovations for Linda, and he told investigators that they had remained good friends, with Linda recommending him for her clients. He strongly denied that he had any involvement or knew any knowledge about Linda's murder, and investigators let him go. Linda's ex-assistant, Raul Garcia Bernal, was also questioned about his whereabouts at the time of Linda's murder. A number of Linda's friends had said that she had recently had a falling out with Raul. The friend said, "Raul was a handsome young guy and he led Linda on, so she thought they would have an affair. As far as I know, they never did." They had also co-brokered deals, but Linda had come tired of Raul constantly chasing women. According to one friend, Raul had an eye for models. The friend said that Linda wanted Raul out of her life and told him through an intermediary that there would be no more co-broker deals. Furthermore, he was one of the few friends who did not call Linda's family to offer condolences, which many people found to be very suspicious. According to the police source, Raul was not charged and was let go, but investigators said that they may call him back to be questioned further. 3 marijuana dealers that sold Linda were also tracked down and interviewed, including 2 college-age men and a doorman who worked on a nearby building. Investigators were also trying to piece together a timeline of events leading up to Linda's death. Her daughter said that she had last seen her at around 9 a.m. on the day she was murdered. She found her dead around 13 and a half hours later, giving investigators a relatively large time frame to investigate. When Linda was found, she was wearing jogging clothing, which suggested that she had just returned from her daily walk in Central Park. Investigators working on the case said that the crime scene was pristine. In addition to the lack of forced entry, there was no sign of a struggle. Nothing had been stolen, and there was not even a pillow out of place. As investigators were working tirelessly on the murder case, Linda's family were busy preparing for her funeral, which was to be held at Riverside Memorial Chapel in Manhattan. Seymour was devastated by the death of Linda. While they had been separated for a long time, they had remained the very best of friends and spoke almost every single day. In a statement, he said, "We were much better as best friends than husband and wife. She had a biting sense of humour and we laughed most of the time." He fondly recalled that Linda was the role model and mentor to their two daughters, and that they would be comforted by the memories of their mother. Before the closed casket funeral, the family went to the mortuary to view Linda's body for the last time. Samantha said that they told their mother, as she lay in her coffin after being prepared for the funeral, that they would find whoever killed her and ensure that justice was served. At the funeral service, mourners gasped when Samantha told them that Linda's wounds were so horrific that it had taken more than 3 hours for her body to be prepared for the funeral. During the service, Seymour said, "We had a magical 6-year run, and as best friends, we had a relationship that will last through eternity." He said that it still hadn't sunk in that Linda was gone, and said he had called her phone several times. The family's rabbi, Emil Hirsch, also had pleasant words to say about Linda, stating, "Linda lived in New York, and New York lived in her. The real New York is like Linda. She had an edge to her." The funeral was attended by a number of celebrities, including Whoopi Goldberg, Trudy Stidler, Paul Schaefer, and Brett Ratner. Outside of the service, Joey Ramone's brother, Mickey Lee, said that he would miss his drinking buddy of 30 years. Just days after the funeral, it was announced that Francisco and Raul had both been ruled out as suspects in Linda's murder, because they did not appear on the apartment complex's security footage from that day. They had not entered or exited the apartment complex, ruling them out. It would also be discovered that Mandy, the daughter who discovered her body, had also been interviewed. Her lawyer, Edward Hayes, was quick to state that Mandy had a rock-solid alibi and had been cooperating with the investigation to try and catch her mother's killer. He stated, "She has an absolutely airtight alibi, composed largely of strangers. What she doesn't have is any blood on her or her clothing and no motive. She loved her mother and there were no disputes." Following the update, investigators would remove a section of Linda's door to be forensically analysed. It was revealed that the metal doorframe could potentially yield a ridge detail print, which could potentially identify a suspect. They also removed the bathtub in the hopes that the killer may have washed off traces of blood and left behind some kind of evidence. Sadly, however, it would turn out that a fingerprint found on the doorframe had been smudged and was unusable. Just the following day, there was a massive break in the case when it was announced that 26-year-old Natavia Lowery had been arrested for Linda's murder. Natavia was Linda's personal assistant, and it was revealed that she had made statements which implicated herself in Linda's murder. Natavia had been the last person to speak with Linda before she was found dead, and an investigation into her background revealed that Natavia had been arrested back in December on a misdemeanor charge of identity theft. Unbeknownst to Linda, Natavia had been accused of stealing a high school friend's identity and then using it to open accounts at Target and T-Mobile. However, the misdemeanor charges against Natavia had eventually been dropped and the case had been sealed. Linda's former personal assistant had been fired in the summer, and Natavia had been hired in June or July. Since Linda did the bulk of her work on the telephone or at social events, Linda needed somebody to help type up contracts, keep track of listings and appointments, and coordinate emails between Linda and her clients. Natavia had access to all of Linda's clients' social security numbers, bank routing numbers, and all of the financial information that is associated with closing a deal. During a press conference, it was revealed that Natavia had admitted to murdering Linda. She had said that she was tired of constantly being yelled at and reprimanded by Linda. She said that Linda had been verbally abusive towards her on the day of the murder, had used profanity and derogatory and racist language. She said that the day had started out pretty regularly, with Natavia being asked to retrieve some emails. She said that Linda then criticised her for being too slow and blew marijuana smoke in her face before apologising to her. According to Natavia, Linda then asked if she could buy her lunch, but Natavia replied by saying no, and that she didn't need her money because she had her own money. Natavia said that Linda then became irate and said, "That's the first time I hear somebody black saves their money," and that she should take the free lunch. Natavia said that this had struck a nerve worse than anything she had said before. She said that she snapped and grabbed a yoga stick and hit Linda 6 or 7 times in the neck and head.
She's just like in my face, and she's just like yelling and screaming and cursing. And I'm looking like asking myself, who the heck, like, what the heck is going on? You know, I'm like, why am I here? Like, what's going on? How did I get to this point? You know, I'm asking myself that. And I'm like, looking at her like, okay, what's wrong with her? You know, because she just looks crazy right now. Her hand is, you know, going like that. And then she had like her, it's like a wooden baton type thing, you know.
Is it made of wood or some other material?
It's wood.
Okay. And what is it used for?
Yoga. Yoga, she goes for a walk.
Okay, and can you describe it to me?
It's like, I don't know if you ever seen people do yoga. They put it on their shoulders, they stretch, they turn. It looks like a king.
And how long is it about?
Probably like the length of a king, but without that hook.
Uh-huh.
So she's pointing the cane at me now, right? So I move the cane. You know how you just like slap it?
Where were you? You're still on the couch?
Mm-hmm. So I'm still on the couch. So she's like waving the cane and stuff at me. Then it's like, I don't know, like after that remark and stuff, and you know, her screaming and yelling, I just snatched it from her. So I took it and it's like, I just hit her with it.
Where about her body?
Like right here. But it's long. So, you know, okay. It like reached.
So you hit her the first one in the back of her head, and then what happened?
And I did it like a couple more times.
On her head? After the first time she fell, and then you continued to hit her on the head with the stick?
Yes.
Do you know how many times you hit her?
I wasn't myself. I can't count. It was just like, I was mad. I was confused. I was angry, paranoid. It was like a feeling like I never had before.
She said that she had then gone into shutdown mode, and that when Linda fell to the ground, she struck her 5 more times. She described how she didn't see any blood and how Linda's eyes were closed. She said that after stopping hitting her, she was still in shock, and repeatedly said Linda's name, but obviously received no reply. Natavia then fled from the apartment, taking Linda's cell phone and ATM card. Natavia knew Linda's PIN number. She took the ATM card to a nearby ATM, lifted out $800 and picked up a call to the cell phone, telling the client that Linda was too busy to speak. Natavia later returned the cell phone to Linda's apartment. Her trips in and out of the apartment complex were captured on surveillance tape, which showed her nonchalantly carrying out a bag, which presumably contained the murder weapon. Natavia claimed that her intention was not to kill Linda, stating, "My intention was not to hurt her, not to kill her. It was like, leave me alone." as news of the arrest made its way throughout the area. There were clashing reports of the type of person that Natavia was. Her mother, Lottie Lowry Walshed. Everyone loves her. If you'd have met her, you'd love her. While her uncle said that she had a heart of gold. These descriptions were the complete opposite of descriptions from people who knew Natavia during college. A former friend said that she had stolen $250 from her when they shared a hotel room on a school trip to Washington, D.C., and stated, "She was a fraudulent person, very deceiving." The same friend said that when she confronted Natavia, she barely reacted and certainly didn't feel any guilt over what she had done. A former high school classmate said that Natavia was a pathological liar. Natavia had grown up in her grandfather's home in Brooklyn, New York, and was kicked out of Brooklyn Lachlan Memorial High School before attending Murray Bergantrum High in Manhattan. A number of people who knew her in high school said that she was nice. After she graduated, she held a clerical job at the Rogers & Cohen public relations firm from 2001 to 2002, before enrolling in North Carolina State. While here, she was briefly a member of a modeling group called Black Finesse. Natavia did not graduate from North Carolina State, but she did get a business degree from Hunter College. She moved to Virginia Beach, Virginia in 2006, where she was sued for not paying $515 in rent. Within months, she was back in New York, where she worked for a temporary agency called Axion, which found her a clerical job with Planned Parenthood, before finding her a job with Linda. Following the confession, Natavia appeared in court, where she was charged with second-degree murder. As she was led away from the courtroom, her mother shouted out, "We love you, don't say nothing." According to her family, Natavia had been targeted because she was black, and said that Linda's own daughter should be looked at as suspects. One relative stated, "They know who did it, but wherever there's someone involved with power and influence, black people get scapegoated." Natavia's lawyer, Gilbert Paris, spoke outside and said that his client was innocent. He said that the confession had come at 6 a.m. after she was questioned throughout the night without him present. According to investigators, however, Natavia had waived her Miranda rights, and they had allowed her to sleep and eat while she was being held at the police station. The police commissioner, Raymond Kelly, would credit the investigators with gaining Natavia's trust during the interview and said that she must have realized that they were closing in on her. He stated, "We took her out of her atmosphere and brought her into our atmosphere. We had questions for her, and they were tough questions, and she answered them." After it was revealed that Natavia had claimed that Linda had been abusive towards her, Samantha and the family's lawyer, Eddie Hayes, revealed that Linda had been diagnosed with a brain tumour in the weeks before her murder. The medication she was on for the brain tumour had made her prone to outbursts. Eddie said that Linda had always been prone to mood swings, but that, combined with her medication and illness, intensified them. He stated, "People who worked with her knew this, and when she had one of her outbursts, they walked away. They did not pick up something and start swinging." Samantha said that even if her mother did shout at Natavia, she didn't deserve to be murdered, and said that her mother had been very kind to Natavia, being paying for her boyfriend to fly out to New York for her birthday. This episode of Morbidology is sponsored by Yarn, an interactive storytelling app where stories are told as text messages between the main characters. It offers everything from true crime child fiction stories to even choosing your own adventure. They have series such as Mystery Dog and Haunted Camper, but my favourite has got to be their latest podcast, Strange Street, where you follow the main character, Cece, into a mysterious alternate universe. It had me guessing the entire time. So if you love true crime podcasts, then Yarn is the app for you. Tap through the most addictive and immersive stories today, only on Yarn. Trust me, with over 27 million downloads, Yarn is a must play. Download Yarn for free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's Y-A-R-N. Download it today to watch, read, and listen to all of your favorite fiction stories. From steamy to horror, Yarn has it all. According to both Linda's family and Natavia's family, the pair were close. Natavia's father, Danny Lowery, said that Linda's drinking and marijuana use had bothered Natavia, and that in the weeks before Linda's murder, Natavia had encouraged her to begin Alcoholics Anonymous. Many of Linda's friends would scoff at the allegations that she had been racist towards Natavia, and some had even said that Linda had told them that she wondered whether Natavia was making unauthorized charges on her credit cards. However, it wasn't known if she had confronted Natavia or not. It would soon be discovered that after making the confession, Natavia had claimed to her family that she had been coerced, and that she had no idea who killed Linda. According to her aunt, Julia Caro, Natavia was taken into the interrogation room and was told that her mother would be filing out a missing person report if she did not confess to the murder. She claimed that Natavia had begged to be allowed to call her family, but was not allowed. NYPD Deputy Commissioner Paul Brown refuted this and said that the confession was not coerced. He said, "She contacted detectives herself and voluntarily answered questions." However, Natavia's lawyer said that he had contacted investigators and told them that they could not speak to her alone without him present, but they did it anyway. Following this, Edward Hayes, the lawyer for both Samantha and Mandy, said that the prosecutors may have trouble convicting Natavia because of how her confession was obtained. He said, "It was clearly manipulative for them to meet with her because she was still a suspect in their minds." According to a number of defense lawyers as well, they believe that Natavia's confession could be deemed inadmissible in court. It would be revealed that Natavia had first met with investigators on the 31st of October. And according to our defense lawyer, Gilbert Paris, he had informed investigators during that meeting that they were not allowed to question his client without his permission. Then on the Thursday, Natavia called investigators to complain that reporters were camped outside her home. The two lead investigators on the case, Kevin Waller and Antonio Rivera, made plans to meet Natavia at the Kellogg's Diner. After meeting, they took Natavia back to a precinct house, where she waived her Miranda rights and confessed to the murder. According to high-profile defense lawyer Ronald Kuby, investigators may have infringed on Natavia's rights by not contacting her lawyer before questioning her. Natavia would appear in court on the 14th of November, where she was indicted on the murder charge. As the charge was read out, several of her relatives started to scream and shout. Many of them called the investigators on the case liars, while one yelled, "Do a good job next time, asshole." Before the month of November came to a close, Samantha and Mandy's lawyer once again raised some questions about the murder case. He said that while Natavia had claimed to use a yoga stick to murder Linda, he questioned whether this was true. According to Linda's yoga instructor, Linda didn't have a yoga stick. In fact, she didn't even know what a yoga stick was. Furthermore, he doubted that a yoga stick would be heavy enough to inflict the injuries that had been inflicted on Linda. Also, when Natavia confessed to the murder, she had a difficult time describing the yoga stick. In an email, Deputy Commissioner Paul Brown said that Natavia could have gotten confused with some kind of other exercise equipment, stating, "The NYPD never said that the yoga stick was the weapon. We said she told detectives it was. She may well have used something else." All the talk of the confession and now the supposed murder weapon had many people questioning, was this case not as simple as it appeared to be? In a murder case this massive, of course the police are under a lot of pressure to have the case quickly resolved and the perpetrator arrested. But now, people were left wondering if the police had acted too hastily in who they arrested. Natavia would appear in court again before the end of the month, where she would plead not guilty to the murder of Linda. During the hearing, more information regarding Natavia's confession was released. First of all, Natavia had denied any knowledge about Linda's murder. Just the day after the murder, she had told investigators during an interview that Linda was lovely to her, but said that she was a drunken control freak who often made racist rants towards other people.
It was like, it felt like she was like my worst enemy, you know? So it's like, how do you go from somebody, you know, like a best friend, you know, to an enemy, you know? Like, I used to talk with her and just be like, you know, because she used to always curse people out and stuff. Like, she didn't care. She would, you know, always say, like, little racial things. And I'd just be like, Linda, you can't do that, you know? And...
Did you feel insulted when she would say these racial things, even if they weren't about you?
Right, you know? And then I'll say sorry to the person, you know? And I'll just be like, I'm so sorry. You know, she's just having one of those moments.
After a while, she then blamed a fictional masked man. She told investigators that she entered the apartment at 10 p.m. and saw a masked man dressed in black and armed with a hammer. She said, I stood near the foyer and the next thing I know, I heard Linda screaming, What the fuck are you doing here? Get the fuck out of my house. I hear 7 thumps. She said that the man threatened her not to say anything about what she had seen. However, she was then presented with the fact that no such man was spotted on the apartment complex security videos. She then changed her version of events and said that it was her who killed Linda.
I started praying.
Did you start feeling badly about what you had done?
Mm-hmm.
What else were you feeling?
I felt bad. I felt sorry. Really sorry.
Outside of court, her defense lawyer accused the police of coercing the confession, stating she had to make something up to get out of that room. He also revealed that from behind bars, Natavia had learned that she was pregnant with her fiancé's baby. In early December, a bail application was filed for Natavia. According to the affidavit, Natavia said that she had been interviewed for 13 hours. And during those 13 hours, the investigators had told her that they had called her lawyer and that they had called her parents, but no such calls were ever made. Defence Kubi argued that the confession and the waiver of counsel that Natavia had signed were invalid. A bail hearing was scheduled, and during the bail hearing, Assistant District Attorney Joan Iluzzi Orban said that Natavia should not be allowed bail because the murder was particularly brutal. She said that Linda had been smashed over the head and neck at least 10 times, and that her skull had essentially been bashed in with 3 or 4 vertebrae crushed and her neck broken. She said that Natavia's knowledge of the murder was extremely specific and included things that could only have been known by somebody who was there. She also revealed that Natavia had been stealing from Linda. Defence Kubi countered this and accused the prosecution of hyperventilating about his client. He said that the purpose of bail was to ensure that the defendant returned to court, adding that there was nowhere Natavia could go, nor did she have any desire to go anywhere. He said that Rikers Island Jail was a terrible place for neonatal care, and that Natavia needed to be at home to go through her pregnancy. He once again reiterated his belief that Natavia's confession was taken illegally. Assistant District Attorney Joan Iluzzi Orban said that the case didn't hinge on the confession, and said that there was more evidence against Natavia, and that the prosecution believed that the murder occurred because Natavia was about to be exposed as a thief. She said they had tapes of Natavia pretending to be Linda and getting credit cards on her accounts. In fact, just days after Linda's murder, Natavia had purchased herself tickets to Virginia Beach to go and see her fiancé. She revealed the charges of identity theft grand larceny, and fraud were pending. She said, "Lowry is a wolf in sheep's clothing, one of the most devious, manipulative persons I've prosecuted in 20 years. There was some drama in the halls of the courthouse following the bail hearing, when Natavia's mother, Lottie, got in the face of Mandy and accused her of murdering her own mother. She shouted, 'You know you did it,' as court officers rushed into the hallways to try and separate the women. Ultimately, the judge would deny bail for Natavia. Before the year came to a close, Samantha and Mandy announced that they were considering to sue their mother's employee, Prudential Douglas Elliman, as well as the temp agency that employed Natavia. It would be revealed that despite an exhaustive search, they had been unable to find any will left behind by their mother. They filed a petition in Manhattan Surrogates Court asking for control of Linda's estate, which was approved the same day. The estate was worth $2.2 million, which was handed over to Samantha and Mandy. Early next year, it was publicly revealed that Natavia had systematically stolen tens of thousands of dollars from Linda. She had withdrawn so much money from Linda's accounts that the district attorney had to shift a financial forensic analyst full-time from their fraud division to assist the prosecution. In addition to purchasing tickets to Virginia Beach in the aftermath of Linda's murder, Natavia had also attempted to open up more accounts in Linda's name, despite the fact that Linda was dead. Following the revelation, it would be further revealed that Linda's toxicology report revealed no traces of marijuana in her system. The crime scene had also failed to show any evidence that Linda had been smoking marijuana around the same time that she was murdered. Defense Kubi was seemingly failing with his attempt to get Natavia's confession thrown out of court, so he next decided to claim that it was impossible for Natavia to have murdered Linda. He said the prosecutors accused Natavia of killing Linda at around 12:45 p.m. Security footage had captured her leaving the building at 1:15 p.m. However, Defense Kubi said that Samantha had told police that she last spoke to her mother on the phone at around 2 p.m. He also said that Linda's core body temperature was 86 degrees, 12.6 degrees lower than that of a normal living adult. He said that this much warmth indicated that Linda had died later than prosecutors had said, and he estimated her time of death to be around 3:15 p.m. after Natavia had left the apartment. He stated, "If there is evidence that Linda Stein was alive and well after Defendant Lowry left the premises, then Lowry could not have been the killer." He accused the prosecution of sitting on evidence that could clear his client. Then in March, Defense Kubi revealed that male DNA was discovered in the bathroom sink, mixed with Linda's blood. He suggested in a letter to the Manhattan State Supreme Court that the male DNA had come from Linda's real killer. He also said that Linda's blood was found spattered throughout her apartment, yet there was not one spot of blood on Natavia or her clothing. With this letter, he argued for bail, but State Supreme Court Justice Mickey Scherer would deny bail once more. However, she did say that she would hold a hearing on whether Natavia's confession was obtained legally or not. According to a source close to the case, the DNA had been discarded because there had been a male assistant in Linda's apartment the day before her murder, and it was believed that the DNA had come from a tiny flake of skin, as opposed to from blood. There would be no real update in the case until around 3 months later, when the mystery DNA was identified. It would be discovered that the male DNA in the sink had come from a crime scene technician. Officer Anthony Segnod had accidentally contaminated the crime scene by washing his hands in the sink before it had been forensically examined. A tiny drop of his blood was discovered in the sink mixed with Linda's own blood, near one of the faucet handles. When the discovery was announced, Defense Cooney scoffed, "Did he use towels too?" and suggested that other evidence could have been contaminated or lost. Around the same time, Natavia gave birth at Elmhurst Hospital. The following month, Natavia fired defense Cooney and hired a new defense lawyer, Rick Jones. Shortly thereafter, Natavia was hit with a flurry of additional charges. An indictment added grand larceny, forgery, and identity theft charges. She pleaded not guilty to all of the additional charges. In January, there was a pre-trial hearing during which Detective Kevin Waller testified that Linda had a very strained relationship with Samantha and Mandy, and that she constantly fought with them. In fact, on many occasions, she even had Natavia write emails to her daughters. He testified that Natavia had told him that Linda had complained in the past, that Mandy was just looking for money. Natavia had also told Detective Waller that Linda had been smoking a lot of marijuana in the lead up to her death, and that once a month a drug dealer would deliver $600 worth to the apartment. During the hearing, prosecutors would play Natavia's taped confession, and the judge would ultimately rule that the confession could be entered as evidence. As the murder trial was approaching, Mandy and Samantha sued Douglas Elliman, the real estate firm that had hired Natavia. They charged that the company had placed their mother in a dangerous situation by hiring Natavia, and accused the company of not doing their homework before hiring Natavia, who had multiple arrest warrants against her. The wrongful death lawsuit was seeking unspecified damages. In early January of 2010, the murder case went to trial. In opening statements, defense lawyer John Christie admitted that Natavia had stolen from Linda, but said that she did not kill her. He stated, "Natavia stole. She stole a lot. That is wrong." Speaking about the confession, he turned to the jury and said, "She made it up to give police what they wanted to hear." He noted that the confession had come after 12 hours of interrogation, without the attorney her family had hired for her. Defense Christie said that Linda had many enemies, and even suggested Mandy and Samantha could have been responsible for their mother's murder, stating, "Both daughters were having financial difficulties. They stood to inherit a lot of money from Linda Stein's estate." During the prosecution's opening statements, Manhattan Assistant District Attorney Joan Ildozi Orban said that Natavia had murdered Linda simply to silence her about the more than $30,000 she had stolen. She said that during the confession, Natavia had given a version of events that made the murder sound like a crime of the moment, as opposed to what it really was. "Getting caught stealing and killing the person who has caught you." She said that Natavia's drive to steal was so strong that straight after the murder, she stole $800 from Linda. She informed the jury that security footage from the apartment complex picked up nobody but Natavia going to Linda's apartment on the day of the murder. On day one of the trial, the 911 call from Mandy was played out. The desperation in her voice was evident as she sat in the courtroom alongside her sister. They both cried as the wails from the 911 call emanated in the room. Mandy would be called to testify in regards to the grim discovery. She said that when she found her mother's body, it was cold. She said that at first, when she saw the body, she didn't recognize it as her mother. She said that earlier on in the day, she had called her mother and Natavia picked up and told her that she was out running. She told the jury that she thought this was strange because her mother didn't run. After Mandy's testimony, Natavia's defense made a bid to try and pin the murder on her. A number of emails were presented between Mandy and Linda and showed that their relationship was marred by arguments. In one email, Mandy asked whether she could borrow a car, to which Linda replied, "Absolutely not. You cannot borrow anything from me until you show some respect. Stop blaming me for your circumstances. There is no room in my life for your attitude or disrespect." During cross-examination, Defense Christie grilled Mandy. They accused her of being inconsistent in what she told police about finding Linda's body, and asked whether she had blood on one or both hands. Under cross-examination, Mandy admitted that her relationship with her mother was tumultuous. She described Linda as controversial and said that they fought over money. She also said that several weeks before Linda was murdered, She kicked her daughter out of her apartment where she was staying to work on a documentary about CBGB that Linda had helped fund. A number of emails were excluded between Mandy and Linda, and the judge warned the defense not to cast suspicion on Mandy without any evidence. Prosecutor Elozy Orban lambasted the theory that Mandy was involved, stating, "Just because you had a fight with your mother a few weeks before her death does not mean you killed her." The defense then tried to suggest that one of the construction workers could have killed Linda. They called building supervisor Ed McQuaid to the stand, and he said that Linda had yelled at the construction workers for being too loud. He stated, "I believe she had words with some of the workers." Ed had managed the property for 12 years and told the jury that it was impossible for someone to enter the building without being captured on camera. Security cameras picked Natavia coming and going several times, and at one point she was seen carrying Linda's turquoise handbag, as well as a red shopping bag, which was sagging with the weight of something heavy. She left for good at 5:04 p.m. Mandy is then seen on tape arriving at 10:21 p.m, and 4 minutes later Ed is seen rushing to the apartment where he had been alerted to by Mandy. The defense pointed out that Natavia was wearing khaki pants in the security footage, but there was no sign of any blood spatter. The murder was particularly brutal and blood was spattered across the floor and walls of Linda's apartment. Under cross-examination, Ed said that he did not see any blood on Natavia when she left the apartment complex. Following this, the jury were handed a selection of crime scene photographs, including graphic photographs of Linda, face down in a puddle of her own blood, her face mangled by the heavy object that had been smashed across her face and head. Mark Benek, a friend of Linda, would testify next. He told the courtroom how just the day before Linda was murdered, she had asked him, "What would you say if you thought someone was stealing from you and not doing right by you?" According to the prosecution, they believed that Linda had confronted Natavia about her stealing from her, and an argument had ensued, and ended with Natavia murdering Linda. Mark also told the jury that on the day of Linda's murder, he had called her around 1:05 p.m. He said that Natavia had answered the phone and told him that Linda was out having a walk. This phone call came around 15 minutes before Natavia was seen leaving Linda's apartment. The security camera never picked up Linda leaving except for that night, when she left in a body bag. Samantha, the second daughter of Linda, would also be called to the witness stand, where she endured an onslaught from the defense, who insinuated that Linda could have been killed by a relative. The defense had Samantha admit that Linda was a recovering alcoholic, and that Samantha and her husband had been under financial strain. On the second week of the trial, it would be revealed that on the day of Linda's murder, Natavia was carrying her cell phone. Minta John, who worked with Natavia, said that on that day, she had lunch with Natavia at a pizzeria, and she noticed that Natavia had Linda's phone. She testified, "She did not order anything. She didn't eat. I asked her why she had Linda's cell. She said she got it from her when Linda was out jogging." Following her testimony, the jury would hear a voicemail that Natavia had left Linda hours after the prosecution said that she beat her to death. They played out the eerie recording to show that Natavia was attempting to create an alibi.
"Hey, Linda. I just want to let you know that I'm leaving work at 5:30. Hopefully the walk in the park was actually good. I left everything upstairs at the door, and Seymour called. He said just give him a call back if he had a question to ask you. And I hope that the showing goes well with Ursula. And I will see you tomorrow. So if you get this before 5:30, you can just call me. If not, talk to you later. Bye."
The voicemail had been left at 6 p.m., but Natavia said, "If you get this message before 5:30, you can just call me. If not, I'll talk to you later." In addition to this message, Natavia left two written notes on Linda's door, one of which had the word 4:17 p.m. written on it, and another which read, "Linda, I waited for you to come back from your run, but you never came to the office. Anyway, call me tomorrow. Good luck with the showing, Natavia. While Natavia was working on creating an alibi, there would be evidence presented to show that the same day, in addition to stealing $800 from Linda, she had also transferred $150,000 from Linda's retirement savings into her own checking account. The transfer had been made at 2:04 p.m. Following this revelation, Natavia had attempted to fire her legal team and said that she was upset with the strategy they were using to defend her. The judge denied the motion, which resulted in her parents creating an outburst in court. Her stepdad, Daniel Walsh, shouted, "She has the right to change counsel," while others screamed obscenities, resulting in six of them being removed from the courtroom. Natavia apparently wasn't happy with the defense's opening statements, wherein her lawyer admitted that she had stolen from Linda. Natavia stated, "I have a different method or theory. It's like I was stuck with that opening statement, even though I don't agree with it." One of Natavia's three lawyers admitted that their communication with Natavia had diminished to zero. According to the prosecution, the attempt to change lawyer or defend herself was just because she was unhappy with how the trial was going. There was overwhelming evidence that she had been stealing from Linda, yet she continued to deny it. Manhattan Supreme Court Richard Caruthers agreed and said that if Natavia wasn't happy, then she would have complained earlier on, not on week two. After the drama in the courtroom, the prosecution dropped a bombshell and blew apart the defense's claims that Natavia couldn't have committed the murder because there was no blood on her khaki pants on the security footage. They showed that upon closer inspection, it looked as though Natavia had turned her pants inside out. On the way into the apartment, large pockets can be seen and no vertical seams. However, on the way out, the pockets seem to be missing and there are no large seams, running from the pant hem all the way along where her pockets had been. It would also be revealed that these khaki pants had never been recovered. Next up would be graphic testimony regarding the injuries inflicted on Linda. Dr. Michelle Sloan described how Linda was hit with a weapon at least 24 times, adding that it could have been as many as 80. She said that the first hit very likely paralyzed Linda, rendering her unable to move. She revealed that Linda's killer had stood on her back at one point during the attack, while beating her with the weapon. She said that long after Linda stopped moving, the killer continued to hit her. Her testimony was accompanied by graphic photographs which depicted Linda's bruised and bloody head, as well as her broken neck. There were no bruises on Linda's hands to indicate that she had fought back. The defense seized the opportunity to ask if the injuries could have been inflicted with a construction tool, such as a pipe, to which the doctor agreed that a metal pipe could have caused the injuries. A wooden object or even a hammer could have been responsible for the star-shaped lacerations that were across Linda's head. She said that Linda could have been killed at any point that day, because when she was found, her body was already in rigor mortis. Towards the end of the trial, the defense would request the jury be allowed the lesser count of manslaughter to be included in a list of charges that the jury could consider. The judge approved the request, meaning that Natavia could be convicted of manslaughter as opposed to murder. The following day, closing arguments began. Assistant District Attorney Elozy Orban told jurors that Natavia was a cunning and flagrant thief who murdered her boss after stealing more than $30,000 from her. She stated, "She is bold. She is not a yay-sayer. She is somebody who does what she wants when she wants to." Defense attorney Thomas Giovanni told jurors during his closing arguments that Natavia had been coerced into the confession. He noted that her confession conflicted with evidence in the case, including the number of times she said she hit Linda and whether Linda was smoking marijuana right before she died. He stated, "Every one of those facts is what the police thought and what they trained Natavia Lowery to say." He accused police of being so bent on pursuing Natavia that they did not investigate other potential suspects. After deliberating for just 5 hours, The jury reached a verdict. They found Natavia Lowery guilty of the second-degree murder of Linda Stein. Outside of court, Mandy said, "I'm just really grateful that my mom's getting justice. I'm too overcome to speak. Just very relieved. Nothing will bring her back, but we are grateful for justice." Natavia's stepfather, Daniel, announced his displeasure with the verdict, stating that Natavia was not violent and was innocent of the murder. The following month, a sentencing phase was held. During the proceedings, Natavia's stepfather, Daniel, stood up and shouted, "She had the right to change counsel under the Sixth Amendment." When he refused to sit down and remained silent, he was hauled out of the courtroom and charged with contempt. This caused the sentencing phase to be pushed back. Outside of court, Natavia's mother, Lottie, snarled the threat, "You'd better wash your back when you go back uptown," to Natavia's defense lawyer. The family were evidently still upset by the fact that Natavia could not change lawyer mid-trial. In May, the sentencing phase of the trial began. In a brief statement, Natavia said, "My innocence will continually remain. This is just the beginning of a new fight, of a new beginning to get a fair trial." Samantha was given the opportunity to speak, and she called Natavia a disgusting person and asked where her apology was or where her remorse was. Mandy revealed that she was 4 months pregnant and cried as she said how her mother would never set her eyes upon her baby. She described how finding her mother's body had haunted her and would continue to do so for life. They both said how they had been re-victimized by the behavior of Natavia and her family, who suggested that they were involved in their mother's murder. Natavia would be sentenced to 27 years and 4 months to life for Linda's murder. In handing down the sentence, the judge called Natavia a very dangerous woman and said that he would recommend that she never be granted parole. He also ordered that she repay the $30,000 she stole from Linda, stating, "Miss Lowery acted with an uncommon and almost inhumane degree of coolness and calculation." Linda Stein lived her life fast and furious, and her death was media fodder for months. Those who knew Linda best said that the media flurry surrounding her death was what Linda would have wanted. Over the years, Linda was known as someone who lived for the battle and someone who put up a fierce battle, both when it came to her career and personal relationships, as well as her medical issues. In that final battle of life and death, however, Linda sadly didn't stand a chance. Well, guys, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so, so much for listening. I'd like to say a big, massive thank you to my amazing new Patreon supporters: Carlos Elvire, Catherine, Tanya Wernham, Hannah Phillips, Rebecca Daly, and Jessica Norman. The support on Patreon truly helps out. As you all know, this is a one-woman podcast, and I am eternally grateful for your support. In return for your support, you can get Morbidology merch, which includes t-shirts, stickers, pins, badges, fridge magnets, and keychains. You also get exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus, which aren't on the regular podcast platforms, as well as bonus content from some of the episodes, and ad-free and early release episodes. You can even request a case for me to cover on the podcast. You can join for as little as $1 a month. There are absolutely no obligations, and you can cancel any time. You can also sign up annually to get 15% off. Can I also ask that if you enjoy Morbidology, please consider leaving me a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever else you're listening. Ratings and reviews are an easy way to support a show that you like. Also, make sure you visit us at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. Until next time, take care of yourself, stay safe, and have an amazing week.
Hi, I'm Carol.
And I'm Holly, and we are the hosts of Fireside Phantoms.
Ooh. On our podcast, we will delight in telling you stories of the strange, twisted, dark, and foreboding.
Creepy, crawly things slinking up your leg.
ghostly hands reaching out from beyond the grave.
And we will ask hard-hitting questions like,
can Slender Man fit into my skinny jeans?
Who is Wrinkles the Clown? And how can he make your child's next birthday party special?
Why shouldn't we invite the black-eyed kids in?
What really is going on at your creepy neighbor's house? And is it okay to peek inside?
And many, many more.
So join us and our forest friends
as we gather around a warm and crackling campfire. This is Fireside Phantoms.